Welcome to Breaking Through with me, Kristen Ralph Finkfeiner, powered by Moms Rising. On the show this week, we talk about voting rights. We talk about building back better. We talk about building change in the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Senate specifically. And we give you tactics that you can use. We also check in with award-winning author who has a new book that's actually a journal, Make Her Story Your Story, your guided journal to justice every day for every woman. We touch base on what's happening with the monthly child tax credit checks, childcare, and pre-K. And we close the show talking about rattling the windows in West Virginia and across the nation and what brings us hope in this really, really hard time. We're going to jump right in with our first guest. We are joined by an amazing, spectacular, wonderful guest, Monifa Bandele, the Chief Strategy Officer of Moms Rising and on the board of Black Voter Matters. Welcome, Monifa.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We are in a big week. We're in a big week where democracy is on the line, for real on the line, not like fake on the line, but for real on the line. And the Senate failed to take action. What should everybody know about democracy right now in this critical moment in our nation's history?
Yeah, what we're learning is that we are in a time where people are actually rolling back voting rights. You know, many of the gains that, quite frankly, our parents and grandparents fought for and won in the mid-60s with the Voting Rights Act of 1965 are under threat. And what that legislation did was it made it necessary for certain states, anytime they made any change to anything from a polling location to the qualifications you need to register to the dates when you can show up, they had to be pre-cleared with the Department of Justice, because those states and others, states that weren't included in the Voting Rights Act, had a history of suppressing Black voters, of discriminating against Black voters, from preventing Black people from even being able to register to vote. And so what we've seen is just the rolling back of the Voting Rights Act over the last decades. And this past presidential election, where we had record turnout of Black voters, of rising electorates, of brown voters, API voters, of youth, young voters turned out in some states 20 points higher than they did in 2016. And so now all of a sudden, you see a huge wave of voter suppression bills on the state level that do the very things that that Voting Rights Act of 1964 tried to prevent states from doing. So polling sites are being closed in Black communities. Being able to have access to more days to early vote is being taken away. And we know that Sunday voting was like a big cultural event, particularly in Southern states for Black communities. They have a souls to the polls Sundays. These are the types of activities that are being shut down, prevented, challenged. I mean, you even have a provision in Georgia where you can't give out water and snacks to people who are waiting online to vote. And this is combined with legislation that are also closing the amount of polling sites and shrinking the number of days, meaning that people will be in longer lines, waiting longer, and a lot more thirsty and even hungrier. So we just kind of see all this throwing the tire in the road, throwing the sink in the road, setting the tire that's in the road on fire because of the huge gains in political power, basically, that Black communities have been achieving over these last few years.
And what's important here is to take a moment. Listeners, let's take a moment. There is not any proven history of people voting too much, of voting being overly used, or of any reason other than voter suppression to create these laws. So we have dozens of states and federal laws that are just really taking democracy out at the knees because some elected leaders, now I'll share, most of these laws are being proposed by Republican Party. Some elected leaders are afraid they can't win on their own. They're afraid right. that without suppressing the vote, they cannot win a popular vote. They can, and so this is a political tactic at disenfranchisement in the United States of America. And do you want to frame this a little bit more for our listeners about the why this is happening? Because sometimes people are like, well, I heard blah. There's a lot of myths out there that need busting.
A lot of myths, because people think about the privilege, the access that they have to transportation, to being able to have a flexible schedule at work and wait in line 7 hours or 10 hours or whatever. You know, you really have to think about when you have one polling site in counties where there's people who are poor and do not have cars. And if they don't show up to work, those each hour they're not at work means less dinner on the table, like physically less dinner on the table. Those things matter in voter turnout and in the ability for everyone to be able to participate politically. But I want to go back to what you said about the voter fraud piece, because that is almost laughable, right? I mean, you and I, Kristen, we're solidly Gen X. We've been working on voter turnout issues for our entire adult lives. You know, there was never a time in my history was like, oh my God, so many people are trying to vote, you know, multiple times. And, you know, vote illegally or vote in multiple places. This is just a myth. You know, this is just a farce to stoke fears and to actually put a talking point in the mouths of legislators behind all of these state level initiatives. The real issue is what you said. There are lawmakers who know that they can't win on their own. So they are suppressing the vote. The other thing they're trying to do, though, Kristen, is gerrymandering. If they can't win their district on their own, if they can't suppress the vote enough by requiring IDs that people don't have, making it too long and too far for folks, then it's like, well, let's just redraw my district in a way that will give me an advantage. And we also see that happening all over the country. There are, when you look at the shape of some of the maps for some of the, you know, congressional districts or even some of the state legislative districts, it's like, whoa, what's happening here? And those lines are being redrawn in a way that benefit the members of the Republican Party. So the voter suppression is really just one piece of how do we rig the system so that we can win? But and by cheating.
By cheating. That's exactly what this is. Let's just say this. This is pretty much the only people who have proposed laws like this are Republican legislators. So not every Republican legislator, but that is who has proposed all of these voter suppression laws. And what the voter suppression laws are about cheating, cheating to win the elections. What can people
It's moving the goalposts, you know, if everyone out there can just imagine once you start to get good and perform well at a sport and then all of a sudden the rules change. That is what has happened to Black people since the 1800s, right? It's like, here are the rules. Here's what you need. Communities put all together all kinds of, you know, acrobats and educational programs and busing people to polls and doing all the things. And as soon as you get to a critical mass, okay, the rules are changing. And that's what continues to happen.
It's so frustrating. What can people do? I know people who are listening right now are so frustrated. They want to join us in changing what's happening. What can they actually do to do that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely follow us, you know, follow Moms Rising. Stay tuned. We're going to be putting out what the next steps are now that we've had the Senate fail to adjust the rules in a way so that the voting rights bill could pass, right? So, but we always say it ain't over till it's over, right? Moms Rising. And so do our partner organizations. So people should definitely follow the Black Voters Matter platforms, see what actions are coming out next week. Just this week, back to back, there have been demonstrations on Capitol Hill where members and activists of organizations like Black Voters Matter and Until Freedom were arrested. And then the next day, there was a day where congressional reps were also arrested at the Capitol, all demanding that there be something done to protect the voting rights of Black communities and other communities of color. So stay tuned, but get involved in these organizations because it is a long haul, right? It is not a sprint. It's a marathon. You know, even if we get certain bills stopped in the states, there's going to be other things that we need to do on the federal level ongoing until we make sure we have a real equitable democracy.
We so need to do this. What else is an emergency in terms of public policy that needs to be moved forward right now in the United States of America, but isn't getting enough attention?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because we have been working nonstop on Build Back Better, which is an amazing omnibus bill that had so many components in it that created the infrastructures that we needed around care, around health, around so many things that we know not only make our communities healthy, but also safe. And so we do hear a lot about childcare. We've heard a lot about home care stuff, and we need to hear more. We're definitely not hearing enough about these things. And these are not only the professions that women, and particularly Black women and women of color, in, but these are also the things that all women typically need more of in order to stay in the workplace and to have family economic security, because we know more and more women are heads of their households. But there's also pieces in there that have really kind of fallen off the radar in terms of Black maternal health and maternal health care overall. There's a component of Build Back Better called the Black Maternal Health Momnibus, which did things like increase Medicaid to 1 year postpartum, and really had some amazing levers in it to make sure that we fight this rising tide in the United States of women dying during childbirth. Many people don't know that in this country, Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women. And Indigenous women face these same horrific stats. And that if you were to kind of split us out, Black and Indigenous women, onto our own, we have rates of maternal mortality, death during pregnancy, of countries where they don't have a lot of hospitals, where there's not access to clean water, where there's actually war and conflict. Those are the levels of maternal death that we're facing. And in fact, across the board, the United States has the highest maternal mortality rate of all developed nations. And so this momnibus piece of Build Back Better is also very critical, right? And it's also something that we need to keep on the radar. And we cannot forget about paid family medical leave, especially during a global pandemic. Right? I mean, I'm in New York. I'm sure the listeners are all over the country, but everywhere you go, things are shut down because people are out sick. You know what I'm saying? Schools, restaurants, shops, agencies that you need, we're showing up and it's closed because half the staff is home to quarantine. Well, how can people make it if we don't have paid family leave moving forward? We haven't found a silver bullet that's pulling us out of the pandemic. Hopefully it's starting to get better, but this is also another component that cannot fall out of the conversation.
So important. Everybody, we need your voice right now. Call your U.S. Senator. You can either look up your U.S. Senator's number on Google and give him a call, or we have you covered. You can text We Care, just the words WECARE, to 747-464, and we'll connect you right away. It's free. It's free. We are your free activation service. Text We Care to 747-464 and we will connect you right away with your U.S. senators. You'll hear like a little sample message that you can say, then boom, you're connected. You can leave a message with their office. Monitha, we have just 1 minute left with you, and a lot of people are feeling a ton of despair right now. They're watching what's happening in the Senate, where we have just a couple members of the Senate and every single Republican voting down voting rights, of all the ridiculous things, and, you know, stalling on some really important policies. Do you have any words of hope that you can share with our listeners, as you have won many battles previously, and in this moment is a moment of a big battle?
You know, Kristen, I have to like lean on our mentors and elders. They're so wise. And what they've been telling us lately is that all the great wins, all the historic wins that we talk about, as they got closer to winning, they faced huge opposition. Opposition grew as they got closer to that finish line. You know, as they became the change makers that we tout today, they were hugely unpopular. You know, we just came off of Martin Luther King Day. You know, Dr. King polled unfavorably amongst most Americans in his entire 39 years, right? 75% disapproval rate. As it got closer to his assassination, 80% disapproval rate. There was not support for the Civil Rights Act. And so what we have to remember is that that opposition that's growing and growing, and the backlash that we're feeling, is because of these wins that we're having, especially on the state level. When you and I started, there was 2 states that had paid family medical leave. Then there were 4, then there were 5, then there were 15. You know what I'm saying? And so we're picking up momentum. And so there is the backlash, there's the opposition, but I feel confident I am optimistic, and I know that we're going to carry this through. And we're also going to carry through criminal justice reform. You know, Moms Rising and all of our partners were hugely involved in the summer of 2020 to say enough is enough. We need new systems of public safety. And we all watched as the bill that Congress advanced, Justice and Policing, also called the George Floyd Act, died. And so, yeah, it is. There's a lot of despair out there. But guess what? A new Congresswoman, Cori Bush, has introduced the People's Response Act, really building off of the demands of the summer of 2020. And it's been introduced and it's gaining speed. So don't give up, everyone. We are winning. We are going to win. Victory is certain. All the things that the elders keep telling us, they face huge opposition and they still were able to change the course, change the direction of the country and our communities. And we're going to do the same.
Yes, we are. Thank you so much for being on. Monifa Bendele, thank you, thank you, thank you for all that you do. Thank you.
Thanks.
We're going to take a quick break, but stick around. We'll be right back with our next guest who's talking about her new book, Make Her Story Your Story. She has tips for you to use for your own writing and journaling. We'll be back in a quick moment. We're going to fight for Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rao Finkbeiner, powered by Moms Rising. We are joined by a guest you are going to love hearing from, award-winning author Rebecca Sive. We're going to be talking about her new book, Make Her Story Your Story, your guided journal to justice every day for every woman. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm just delighted to be here with you.
I'm even more delighted. How did this book come to be? I also tend to be an author of books at times. And there's sometimes is a moment where it like crystallizes for me. Okay, this is like what needs to be written right now. I'm just going to take pen to paper or typing to computer and, you know, put it out there. What's the origin story of this new book, Make Her Story Your Story, for you?
You're exactly right. There's that moment. And for me, it was during the pandemic, really, when I was looking at the doctors and the nurses and the EMTs and all these people doing such wonderful work and thinking, well, what can I do that would be helpful? And of course, like you, I'm an activist on behalf of women and an advocate for women. And it occurred to me that both during the pandemic and then certainly as we came out of it, you know, we were going to have to renew and regenerate and figure out how we wanted to keep on this path of justice and opportunity for women. And I started, I had this idea about journaling because I'm always putting little pieces of paper in envelopes, right? And no, I need to be, you know, better organized. And as I looked around, I didn't see a journal that was really focused on our public lives, right? On the work we do in our communities and civic life. And so I explored that some more and just thought, well, let me try to put pen to paper. And that's exactly, you know, what I did, and fortunately found Strong Arm Press, who were eager to publish it and in a timely way. And so that was the origin story. I just got to sit down and try to do this.
And so when you get the book, which is also a journal, what's happening? What's the experience for the person holding this object?
Well, the idea is it's a journal slash workbook. And the idea is to sort of methodically and take each of us who decides to do the journal through a process. The book is divided into three parts. So first you imagine, right? Like you imagined Moms Rising, right? And then you develop an idea in your mind, then create, and then organize. So there are three parts to the journal. And in each part, there's a sort of double page spread, which if you can visualize this, has a compelling sort of motivational graphic and some text there, and then some prompts as you would find in other journals, and then space for you to write. The back end of the journal, there are some places where you can record, for instance, the names of organizations you want to join, the, you know, quotes from famous women you want to remember. And so the idea is if you do this going through, imagine, create, organize, at the end, you will actually have identified, you know, the kind of project that you want to do, that you want to participate in, you may even want to lead. So that's how it works. And similar to other journals that aren't dated, I should say, it's when you really have those ideas and want to put them down.
Yeah. And one thing that you lifted up, which I want to double back on, is the importance of creativity in organizing and moving forward justice. A lot of people don't realize sometimes that building a campaign for justice, building a political effort to have transformational policy change is also somewhat like creating a painting or, you know, doing some type of collage work sometimes, because it takes many different tactics and many different messages and many different voices at the same time to make real change that actually does reflect and respect the people of the United States of America. And so I want to talk a little bit about the creative aspect. And the creative aspect is, I was on another call this week and people were bringing up that pessimism is the killer of creativity.
Yes.
Cynicism is a stopper of creative flow. And so how do you, in this moment where we have a pandemic surge rising, where we have legislation being stalled in our U.S. Senate, how are you in a book and a journal about creating justice and change, helping to lift people over that barrier of cynicism and pessimism that many people are facing right now in this particular moment in history?
I'm really glad you brought that up because, you know, I have found certainly in this circumstance and at other times when we've been at low points, for instance, back when we all marched together 5 years ago, you know, there is always a way to come together, to share common concerns, to share a common set of creative ideas about how to address those concerns. And, you know, then there is, and I talk about this a lot these days, as I'm sure you do, then there is the joy in having that experience. So to me, the joy of coming together with other like-minded women mitigates some of that pessimism and unhappiness. Now, it doesn't make the problems disappear, but what it does do is say that, you know, we each have the power to act, right? And how much better we are when we come together and how much better we are when we're well organized. And so the journal really helps in that way, both to, you know, to get organized, to figure out how you can ally with other women, and to feel joyful about the fact that you have figured out some steps to take. And I would just say one more thing about this, that, I mean, and you know this, you know, intimately from your work too, you know, it's so many women focus as we need to on local problems, local challenges, local concerns that need to be addressed. So I think that if it's the case that, for instance, we focus on those kinds of things because that's what we can do and see some immediate results, that's a good thing. And that enables us to experience real creativity to figure out, well, what am I going to do at the PTA? Or what am I going to do about this childcare center that's not, you know, operating properly, whatever the challenge is.
And what kinds of questions should people be asking themselves and maybe even see in the journal that help them figure out where they want to make change? As you just raised, there's so many places that engagement is needed. There's the PTA, there's the school board, there's the city council, there's the state legislature, there's Congress, there's the World Health Organization. I mean, you know, we can go from the whole planet down to just our own little neighborhood in terms of our scale. And let me tell you, listeners, all of our engagement is needed. It's needed everywhere. Making a vibrant community is about having people be involved across the whole fabric of our community, not just one place. So just because you may decide to do one type of engagement doesn't mean it's any better or worse than any other type of engagement. It's more about what speaks to your heart and what's right for you and what enlivens you and sparks that creativity at the same time. So what kinds of questions in the journal will people be seeing to help angle them in?
Well, there's a series of questions. They're focused and they stem from the illustrations. So I'm just going to mention one because I think this will probably resonate. There's a beautiful graphic here that says chill with that misogyny. So the idea here is, and then I wrote about the idea of what it means to demand that misogyny ends, right? And then there's a set of questions related to how are you going to go about doing that. So the idea there is that with these prompts, you figure out these larger issues that always surround whatever organizing project you're engaged in, whatever sort of creative idea you have. So to go back to the examples, you know, whether it's the PTA or the Child Care Center or the World Health Organization or the US Congress, we have to chill misogyny, right? So what are the tactics that I'm going to write down in this journal that I'm comfortable with? How confrontational am I willing to be, for instance? The next one, actually, as it happens, I'm looking at the journal right now, is another wonderful graphic that says it is time to use our outside voices, right? And that's another example. We all have that quiet voice inside of us or in our family, but sometimes, and this is certainly one of those, we have to step outside into the street, into the school, into the library, into the healthcare center, and use that outside voice. And again, there is some descriptive language about how to think about that idea and then prompts for how to figure out how much you want to use your outside voice and how you're going to go about it.
I love it so much. We're talking with Rebecca Saive, award-winning author, and we're talking about her new book, Make Her Story Your Story, Your Guided Journal to Justice Every Day for Every Woman. Now, what has the writing process over time been for you? This is not your first book. You've written many books. And how has that evolved for you? You've gone, it seems like, writing books that aren't journals to writing books that people can write in. And I'll share with you, in my last book, my editor was looking at me funny because at the end and at the beginning, I urged readers to tear up my book, write in it their own words, figure out what worked for them, and, you know, write in the margins and rip out the pages that don't work and put in their own pages that do work. And so writing can sometimes over time become a kinetic experience with community and sometimes not. So what has your writing journey been like?
Well, actually, it's an interesting point. You know, I spent most of my career, you know, as a organizer, activist, doing lots of communications work and policy work. So I've always had to write, for instance, for causes and campaigns and clients. And so at the point when I decided to write Every Day is Election Day, which is a guide for women running for office, I really was propelled to that by what we all shared, which was looking at what happened to Hillary Clinton in 2008. And I thought at the time, well, you know, on the one hand, this was a remarkable achievement, a woman and an African-American man competing for the presidency. And on the other hand, you know, she didn't prevail. And then once again, she didn't either. But the idea there was there's something more here. There's something to talk about how women become leaders, how they stay leaders, how they build their influence. So for me, the writing process, I would say, is always compelled, you know, sort of by those big ideas that we all see around us as we're working. And then secondly, trying to figure out, well, where in that mix can I be helpful? And, you know, these aren't novels. This is nonfiction. It's meant to be useful and inspiring to women. So then there's the, you know, kind of the determination of what's the piece of this that I can contribute. And then, as I sometimes have jokingly said, I just sort of have to lock myself in my room, right? As I'm sure others here have done, and just sort of be disciplined about it. It is a lonely process, as you know. But if you're committed to really helping other women in this way, you can get past that and, you know, set a daily goal for how to write and be willing to, as you just mentioned, you know, accept criticism and go back to the drawing boards.
Yeah, I mean, writing is often a way, for me at least, to really clarify and think. Sometimes I joke that I think with my fingers. And so done right, it is almost a experience where, you know, you might write something where people could write in it like a journal and then people could send it back to you. And, you know, you could learn as you go. It's a learning experience, a learning and a growing experience. Yeah. And I loved also what you just said about, you know, take a minute every day and write. So people out there who are thinking about being writers, one of my favorite books on writing is Anne Lamott's book, Bird by Bird. And she says, write a little bit each day. This is a common theme in writing. So you can get a journal and just write a little bit each day. Create a journal on your computer and write a little bit each day. Everyone, we've been listening to Rebecca Saive, award-winning author, about her new book that you can get called Make Her Story Your Story, your guided journal to justice every day for every woman. You should go out and get it. Thank you so much for being on with us.
Thank you, Kristen.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go away. Next up, we're talking about those monthly child tax credit checks that ended in December 15th. How can we get them back? How can we build change? We'll be back in a quick flash. Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rao Finkfeiner, powered by Moms Rising. We are joined right now by a wonderful, spectacular, amazing guest, Lauren Hipp of Moms Rising, who knows about all the things, each and every single thing. She knows about them, and we're so thrilled to have you on. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so thrilled you're on because we need to talk about the child tax credit. We need to talk about child care. We need to talk about pre-K. We need to talk about what's happening in the United States of America. This week, I saw a study that said 52% of parents are thinking that they're going to be pushed out of the labor force in the next year because we don't have a care infrastructure, because people don't have access to childcare in order to be able to go to work, because people don't have those CTC checks to be able to pay for childcare, because we are in a ridiculous situation. And solutions are on the horizon, and you've been part of pushing solutions forward and succeeding for quite a long time. Right now, the child tax credit expanded checks just stopped. Our last check was December 15th. Can you tell us what's happening right now with the child tax credit and, you know, how people can get involved to make sure that we keep those checks coming?
Yeah. So thanks to the American Rescue Plan that was passed by Congress and signed by President Biden back in March, families were able to draw down much more money. And even families who had no earned income could receive the child tax credit for the first time. And being able to have monthly payments actually made a difference because money is coming in the door as bills were due for families, because bills are due monthly and not annually, like our tax system is set up. And January 15th rolled around, and this was the first time that since this summer that families did not get the benefit of having that monthly check. And it's being felt, right? Families have come to depend on that check to be able to make ends meet, to weather the pandemic. And as Omicron surges and kids are in and out of school, they're in and out of childcare, there are staffing shortages all over the place. Parents have to be in and out of work without paid sick time, without paid family medical leave, and now no child tax credit to help them make ends meet. And this is a really tough time for that to be happening. But there is an easy solution, and that is for Congress and specifically the Senate to get to work and pass Build Back Better, because Build Back Better includes important investments in the child tax credit and expanding childcare, universal pre-K, all of these things that families need to be able to survive and thrive, right, in a pandemic and beyond. And these are things that we knew before the pandemic were issues for families, and they are things that we know that they need when we get to the other side of this.
Lauren, in your history of advocacy, you've encountered a ton of barriers for policies passing, and you have won so many pieces of legislation at the state and the federal level. In this moment in time when newspapers are doom and gloom about legislation moving forward, what is your level of hope about us really expanding the CTC checks?
Well, I never want to underestimate the power of parents and mothers in particular. And these last 2 years have been hard. Like, moms and parents and families are not okay. And I think this past month, you know, we're coming up on exactly 2 years and people are at their wits' end. We have had kids home with us. We have had to bear the brunt of fearing for the safety and health of our families, not knowing what types of policies are going to be there to support us, watching our childcare infrastructure crumble before our eyes, and it wasn't working for us before. And now, like, families and moms are just under this constant weight. And I think that we are at a point where people are going to, like, the gloves are going to come off, and moms and families are ready to, like, throw down and make sure that Congress and the Senate steps up to ensure that there are policies in place that meet the needs of families. And right now they have not shown the courage and met the moment and really looked to see what families are saying that they need. And I think that that boiling point and that anger and that like primal scream that you're hearing from parents is going to be heard in the halls of Congress, because it's like a sonic boom, right? So I do feel hopeful because I believe in the power of people and building power, and that, you know, movements take time. But we've seen a lot of time, and now it's time for action. So I think we have the right policies in front of us. We have the people power, and we will make ourselves be heard.
We absolutely will make ourselves be heard. In fact, I don't know if we want to do this, but I think we should highlight that we have coming up at Moms Rising a rage line. You can find it on the Moms Rising website, momsrising.org. Just go there and find it. But Lauren, can you talk about the genesis of this and what we hope to do with the people who leave messages on the rage line?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is really tapping into what we're hearing and what we're experiencing as parents ourselves, is this rage and nowhere to put it. We don't feel like anyone is listening. So this is both like an emotional release and a place for people to just feel like there is a place for us to collectively let off this steam and this rage that we have, but also it's a place to collect our stories and that anger and direct it towards where it needs to be and where the decisions are being made or not being made, to let the Senate hear us in all of our vulnerability about what we need and the emotion behind it, because we are not okay. And to this point, like, there have been so many articles saying that and like documenting this process, but I think that they need to hear it, and they need to hear it directly from moms and from parents and from families, and feel that emotion and the urgency behind it, so that they're on the journey with us, because they cannot be disconnected from this.
Absolutely. So we're planning on taking out an ad in the New York Times with some quotes that people allow us to use from the rage line to let the Senate know you need to pass Build Back Better immediately. And so let's go back to Build Back Better really quickly. In Build Back Better, in the primary agenda that initially was moving several months ago, there was the child tax credit extension expansion. Those monthly checks were in there to continue. Now we're going to keep pushing for the child tax credit monthly checks to continue, and always through Build Back Better, through any legislative vehicle. But also in the Build Back Better Act is childcare and pre-K, which is critically important, not just for families, but for workers and for our economy and for businesses. And Lauren, can you give us a little bit of an overview about what's happening with childcare and pre-K and why that's so important?
Yeah, so the components in Build Back Better are really looking at the childcare crisis from every angle. It's about increasing wages for the workforce, because we know that they are being paid poverty wages, but they're doing a job that is so critically important, not only to children and families, but also to our overall economy. So really recognizing and honoring that, and paying them compensation that is, you know, adequate. It's also about reducing costs for families so families have affordable childcare that they have access to that meets their needs. It's capping costs at 7% of income, and ensuring that the subsidized rate that goes to providers matches the actual cost of quality, what it actually costs to take care of our infants and our toddlers and our preschoolers. And universal preschool means that all 3- and 4-year-olds will have access to high quality preschool programs that meet their needs, and transition them in to K-12 in ways that are supportive and ensure that they are ready and thriving to join school as they turn 5 and 6.
And one of the things that people don't realize is that, you know, just like we need to build bridges and roads to drive on to go to work, we have to build a care infrastructure, which includes childcare, paid family medical leave, pre-K, and includes home and community-based services and living wages for care workers. Because just like we need to build those bridges and roads to drive on to go to work, we need to build that care infrastructure so parents can actually go to work, In order for parents to go to work, we need to have safe, enriching childcare and pre-K for kids to be in. And so children can thrive with this really important early education. And so care workers can earn living wages. Care workers right now are earning some of the lowest wages in our nation, averaging around $18,000 a year for really important responsibilities, which is raising the future leaders, the future people of America. People, children are people too. Yes, but future adults of America. And yet we're stuck between a rock and the hard place because parents can't pay any more for childcare. Childcare already costs more than college. And we can't pay childcare workers any less. Already, as we just said, childcare workers are earning among the lowest wages in our country, which is ridiculous, awful, and must change. And so we need to build in public investments, just like the K-12 system, public investments into our childcare and early learning system. And the return on investments when we do this are sky high. So when we look at the data, we see that it's really ridiculously economically not smart to not make these investments. And Lauren, can you share a little bit about what the return on investment is when we invest in childcare and pre-K and early learning?
Yeah, I mean, it pays off in so many different ways. Like from a child development perspective, we know that when children have high quality, enriching environments with consistent adult relationships, that they thrive and they do well in school, they graduate, they have better earnings over a lifetime, they have better health over a lifetime. And that's huge, right? That has huge returns to society in many different ways and through many different systems. And for families and for mothers in particular, it boosts their ability to be in the labor market. When you see what we call childcare deserts, where there's not a high supply that meets the demand of families, maternal participation in the labor market drops out. And we know that moms in particular are faced with decisions of whether to reduce their hours at work, whether to work at all because of the expense or availability of childcare. And that impacts them over time. And the lack of childcare produces like somewhere in the ballpark of $8.3 billion in lost wages a year. And that's significant. That's out of families' pockets where they would be spending that in the economy, where they can use that to make ends meet and invest in their family lives. So being able to have access to affordable childcare then allows people to participate in the labor market and then plays dividends down the line in that respect. And then if you think about workers who have children spend an enormous amount of time trying to navigate childcare. Even when they have a childcare set up, there are always snafus and they're always trying to work around that. Their childcare center closes for COVID or their childcare situation breaks down because their childcare center goes out of business. Like any number of things, their kid is out sick. The amount of time that parents and especially moms have to navigate that takes away from what they are able to do and accomplish in a workday, diminishes productivity. So there are lots of ways where childcare is contributing to our economy and the vibrancy of our society. And the more that we invest in it in those good ways, the more that we're going to see that return on investment down the line.
We only have a couple minutes left with you, but what's your advice to listeners who right now want to take action to advance access to childcare, free pre-K for all 3 and 4 years olds, living wages for care workers, and the bringing back of the monthly child tax credit checks for families? Do you have advice on how people can best take action?
I think the best action that people can take is by sharing their stories, taking action with groups like Moms Rising to put our voices together and amplify it towards the Senate and Congress and asking them to pass legislation that lifts families like the Build Back Better Act that includes childcare and pre-K and the child tax credit and paid family medical leave, and so much more that invests in a care economy that supports all families. And talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends, like have it in the water. We want Congress to be hearing this from every corner and why this matters to everyone. It matters for people with kids. It matters to grandparents. It matters to people who are aunts and uncles and care for loved ones. It matters for us all. And we all need to be talking about it. We all need to be invested. And the more that we take action together, the more that we can change.
Thank you so much for being on Lauren Hipp with Moms Rising. Thank you for leading our nation forward. Thank you for all you do. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break, but next up, we're going to rattle the windows. Don't know what we're talking about? Stick around and tune in. We'll be back in a quick moment. We're going to fight for love. With me, Kristen Ralph Finkfeiner, powered by Moms Rising. We are joined by a superstar, Amy Jo Hutchison, who is with Rattle the Windows in West Virginia and Moms Rising and is rattling the windows to help make a better nation. Welcome, Amy Jo.
Hi, thank you so much.
Thank you for being on. I know right now and quite often, all eyes are on West Virginia because Joe Manchin, U.S. Senator Joe Manchin, lives in West Virginia, allegedly represents West Virginia, and is holding up the Build Back Better package, which has so much of what we need for our care economy, our care infrastructure, for our families, for our businesses, for our economy overall. And you're right there organizing, leading change, moving our country forward from West Virginia. And from West Virginia, what do you want everybody in the United States of America across every state to know?
Oh, I think first of all, that we do understand what this means. We get it. And, you know, the fact that Manchin said that he would not support this and that we haven't given up the fight. You know, we're still going. We're still working on this and we're not ready to surrender on it yet.
And what do you think people in West Virginia want Joe Manchin in particular to hear?
You know, I think first of all, we're used to the headlines and we're kind of tired of being told that he's not hearing from any of us because we know that's not true. But also, you know, our state has a median income, household income of around $46,000. And so West Virginians really want him to understand the struggles that we have and the fact that those child tax credit payments were so important to us because they allowed us to take care of our children, you know, in a better way. And I think that's what we really need him to do is to just see us and see the reality of what our lives are like here and to do maybe to base his decisions on that rather than whatever points he's using now.
Yes. And you bring up a really important thing. There are components that are critical to families in West Virginia and in every state in the nation in the Build Back Better package that are being held up. In addition to the monthly child tax credit checks, which ended December 15th because of inaction by the Senate, what other components in that Build Back Better package are so important to the people of West Virginia and, you know, frankly, across the country?
Oh, there were so many, right? Like the minors, their Black lung benefits were tied up in Build Back Better. I mean, there were just so many changes that would make medication affordable. You know, we have so many people here who are insulin dependents, you know, and they really would have benefited for that. But I'm talking to folks about childcare. You know, West Virginians needed childcare that's affordable and accessible and then paid leave. You know, that's so important, especially because there are so many West Virginians who are trying to raise their own families and trying to take care of elderly loved ones at the same time. And I think what folks don't really remember all the time is that when you work low wage jobs, then you have low wage benefits, you know, and without those benefits, like paid leave, then people are forced all the time to make really difficult decisions about staying or remaining in the workforce, entering the workforce, or staying home. And so I just think that it's all those care infrastructure pieces that means so much to West Virginians.
So much. And can you share a little bit? You run, lead, move forward, rattle the windows, which I just love the whole image of rattling the windows in West Virginia, creating and building change. And how did you come to this work yourself and, you know, to the imagery of rattle the windows, which I've always wanted to ask you, but never had time. But how have you come into being here in this space of deep, powerful, and effective advocacy for Build Back Better and more?
Sure. So probably about 7 years ago now, I was an employee. I was a early Head Start teacher, and we were having our pre-training before the year started with our new students. And there was a woman who came and spoke about this organization in West Virginia called Our Children, Our Future. And she talked about grassroots power and the people and organizing, all of which, you know, there were words and concepts that I'd never really heard before, you know? And so I kind of was like, oh, what's this? This is kind of radical for West Virginia. And so I met with her for coffee. At that point, I was leading the parent-teacher organization at my daughter's elementary school, and which was very low-income, high-need. And we started to talk over coffee, and then I started to, you know, attend steering meetings and, you know, calling in and just sitting around on the outside watching and learning what it was all about. And this holds true with a lot of the leaders whom I work with. Like, once you start realizing how these systems work and how it's all related, and the more I learned, the more I wanted to learn. So whenever the position came available, which was a couple of years later, I applied and I got the job. So that's kind of how I got here. You know, with that being said, they were looking for someone that had lived experience of poverty. That was a huge part of it, was the fact that this organization was like, whoa, you know, your pain is it can be used as a tool for change, you know? And so that was one of the things that really struck me about this work, was that it was being led by people that were impacted, but, you know, by the issues. And rattle the windows. My congressional testimony in 2020, when I went to talk about the federal poverty guideline, there was a line in there about shame on you, shame on me, shame on each and every one of us who doesn't rattle the windows of these halls. And that video went viral. And as I was cruising the comment sections, like, people started to pull that out and they were hashtagging it. And there was just really something about the phrase rattle the windows that people connected with. And so now I'm building a movement, Rattle the Windows, which is a grassroots effort to just really develop leaders and organize and, you know, strive toward economic justice, and to do that led by people who are impacted by the issues.
When you are thinking about advising people how to best rattle the windows, I'm wondering what advice you might have for some of our listeners who are fired up and like, yes, I want to rattle the windows too, thank you very much, but don't know where to start. Where should people start?
You know, I think sometimes we can start in our own backyard. You know, start having conversations with people that you know, find out what the issues are that are really affecting them. Like, the heart of organizing is one-on-one conversations. You know, so my questions are geared toward, you know, what issues are affecting you that you know desperately need change in order for you to improve the quality of your life. You know, and I think a lot of times we're shocked by that question because we don't really don't talk about that, right? Like, I mean, it's not a conversation that you typically have with your best friends. Just do that. Like, we have to start talking to each other, and we have to start realizing and developing compassion and empathy for the struggles that other people are living through. And then how can we use, you know, our influence, our voices, our connections, right, our networks, social networks, to bring people together so we can start really growing in numbers and of people who are actively involved, talking to your lawmakers, phone calls, emails, all that stuff, you know, and just to make sure that we're heard and kind of like, we have to start pounding the drums, you know, causing a drumbeat that people can't ignore.
Where do you find hope? We are always up against big barriers for much needed change. And where do you find hope to keep going, to keep rattling the windows?
Oh, these are really good questions. Where do I find hope? I don't think hopeless is, it's never really something that I feel in my work. And the reason why is because I gauge success a lot differently than a lot of folks probably imagine. Like, you know, I was just a woman from West Virginia who grew up in varying degrees of poverty, you know, who was asked to go and talk about CHIP health insurance a few years ago. And then I did that. And then, you know, my kids were on CHIP, and then someone else was, you know, went to that same group of people that invited me and were like, hey, we need someone that can talk about poverty. And they're like, oh, there's this woman in West Virginia. I mean, so it was just about a chance, right? Like, I mean, you know, just aligning all those connections, people who knew people knew me. And so I kind of see it as what that congressional testimony that I gave, like that could have, maybe should have, been in anybody with the same experience, right? With the same lived experience. And so my success is based on, you know, if someone stands up and tells their story, or if someone speaks to a reporter, sometimes my success is just if we just show up, period, and don't do anything, you know. But it's really just about watching people grow and develop into people who want to take a risk, you know, for what matters to them. And that could be a small level risk, you know, like making a phone call to your representative, or it could be a huge risk. You know, like we saw this summer, there were West Virginians in kayaks, right, in front of Joe Manchin's yacht. But I think it's just, to me, it's hopeful to watch people realize that there is something that they can do, and that they can really use their personal stories and their personal pain and turn that into power. And so I don't know if I've ever really been hopeless, because I think, you know, oh, Kristen, like I had this conversation today that there were so many moments, you know, we've been working on this since summer, so it's been such a long road, and there were so many moments where we were just tired and we were exhausted. But within those moments, we've also had all these opportunities to bring more West Virginians together who are struggling with these issues and who have so much in common, right? Like across the political divide, you know, it didn't matter. We're all here worrying about how we're going to support our kids, you know, and how we're going to keep them fed. And so like, I think there would just been so many of those moments because of this, because it has taken so long, you know. Like typically if we would have been over this and this would have been, you know, decided when way or the other 3 months ago, well, then there were hundreds of people out there that we wouldn't have gotten the opportunity to talk to, you know, and to get to know, and to, you know, I mean, even if it's just signing up for an email list, like at least people realize, oh my gosh, I'm not the only one with this experience. I'm not the only one feeling this way, you know? And so anyway, that's my hope. I have hope in the fact that people just want to love and take care of their families, you know, regardless of political party. I think we all want the same things. And so that gives me hope, you know, because as long as there are issues that are like threatening to harm our families, or at least even just, you know, make life a little bit harder, I think there are always going to be people out there who want to speak up and change that.
Thank you, Amy Jo, for inspiring me, people in West Virginia, and people across the entire country each and every day, including today. Thank you so much for being on this show as well. Thanks for all you do.
This was fun. Thank you.
Well, that's it for our show today. Thanks so much for tuning in as we tackle the top topics facing our nation in a way that requires the most boring disclaimer in the history of the planet Earth. Here goes. Views expressed on this show are those of the individual speakers and should not be attributed to Moms Rising, to this station, or to any news or social media service that may disseminate a recording of this show to the public or to any segment of the public. Boom, we'll catch you next week. We're gonna fight for-